I am dreaming of a hole that is downhill. There's a wall behind you. There's some trees on the right, a tree in the middle, and a bowl in front of the basket, kind of, with Obi on the left that is a lake.
GMC hole five.
Joey is the winner.
Yes! Come on!
Wow. That wall.
Like the foundation of an old farmhouse or something is what I think it might be. Like a building. That now
it's like built into the hill.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow, that was impressive, Joey. Once again.
Somebody has to go back and find out what the score is. I have no idea.
It doesn't really matter what the score is. Welcome to the Crush Pepper Podcast. How you doing, guys? How you doing?
Good. We're all together again. No poolside behind us.
We're in Joey's bedroom currently.
Yeah, I was going to set this up outside on the porch because we have a really nice porch, but Mother Nature and the Texas wind had other ideas in mind. So we came up here because we got carpet and a little less reverb than the rest of the rooms.
And it's hopefully also less scorpions.
Yeah, I think this got to be the only room in the house that doesn't need scorpion traps. How many dead scorpions have you seen this week, Simon?
Maybe 10. Maybe probably 20, actually.
Probably 20.
Did you see the live one?
I saw a live one.
Show us the video.
I'm much more comfortable now with scorpions than I was 3 days ago.
I agree 100%.
So that's a win in life, I'd say.
Did you research the consequences of getting stung by a scorpion?
I did.
Oh.
I asked Joey, and he said, oh, it's like a bee sting.
That's what I said.
Oh, maybe I asked Eagle then.
See? Look at that thing.
Wow, yeah. Scorpions are, I mean, I identify with scorpions because I am a Scorpio, born in November. So it's one of my top three spirit animals.
That's why you're so much like my mom.
Thank you.
She was a Scorpio.
Well, two of us were at a tournament last week, the Waco Annual Charity Open. I wanted to break the recap down into a few segments. The first was just to ask Simon, and I suppose I'll also chime in a bit, about the off-the-course highlights of the week, the non-disc golf highlights. For me, our Airbnb was very cool, very nice, out in the country. We are 3 for 3 on dirt road driveways this year, including this place. But last week was really nice. Had a old school record player in the main room and a beautiful yard with a goat farm. And it was ideal for content and a basket and ideal for hosting. I thoroughly enjoyed our spot. What were your off the course highlights that you remember from last week?
Yeah, it's really nice. We're 3 for 3 dirt driveways, so that's really cool. And 3 for 3 countryside vibes. And I mean, this week we're in the Scorpion Palace, basically, 30 minutes outside Austin. This is pretty epic. And last week, yeah, I think my highlight was that we were like 4 minutes from this farmstead that had like a country market, a freaking waffle cafe, and like a huge lunch place with like mini little homemade shops that had like a glass place and a wood place and a leather place. I really enjoyed that little area. It really felt really real and authentic. And that made the Airbnb experience for me just so much cooler because we actually had something that was nearby. Like here, I like this house, but it feels like anything that is convenient is 15 minutes away, which I mean, it sounds a bit sad to complain about 15 minutes, but that's the world we live in, right?
I was expecting there to be the same situation last week with nothing, like going into Waco. So to see that little farmstead, that's a great word, honestly. That's the best way to describe that place. Literally right down the road. That was pretty epic. I didn't end up going to the waffle restaurant, but we did go into the grocery store there, and it was very quaint, and they had... If we weren't so busy, I think we would have been able to do some of the other activities.
Was all this considered Waco, or were you in a little outside town?
We were not even... It wasn't even a town. I mean, we were just in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, like I think the zip code
still said Waco, but it was not in Waco.
It could have been Belmead, but it was about 15 minutes straight north of Brazos East Park. So... Yeah, I always love going to Waco. It's a cute town. It's got everything you need, but it's not overwhelmingly big. I suppose the only thing it didn't have was a high-end dartboard. So we bit the bullet, and I went to Walmart. And, well, first of all, the Airbnb pictures showed a dartboard. So I said, oh, sweet. I don't even have to get a replacement for the dartboard that we had in Florida, which got soaked and grew about 3 inches of mold on it. So
I saw that story. That was wild.
I didn't know they were that organic of a thing. I suppose maybe the Blade 6 is not made out of actual cork, but the one that we had was totally organic and just grew.
You got to keep that thing in the fridge.
I just got to not let it get soaked by an automatic sprinkler for 7 days in a row.
Or that.
So, yeah, I was looking for a replacement, and, well, there wasn't anything good in Waco, so we just bought a really cheap one from Walmart, because once we got to the Airbnb, I saw where it was supposed to be. They left the screw in the wall, but the dartboard was gone, so... But it ended up being a very nice setup when
maybe
it wasn't
windy. Moldy.
Maybe it got moldy. Honestly, it could have. But no, it was really fun. One of my highlights of the week was Steak Night 2.0. Matt Schlebach came over. I did my traditional Sam's Club run. Spent $380 on 19 pre-cut ribeyes. And then shout out to Raul and Malu from MX Disc Golf, two of my really close friends on tour. I guess they're not on tour, but I see them every year in the Texas Swing, and they run a Spanish-only disc golf YouTube channel called MX Disc Golf. And I would consider Raul one of the founding fathers of disc golf in Mexico as far as like organizing a lot of events down there. They came down and kind of spiced up the steak night by bringing a little griddle and a bunch of handmade corn flour tortillas and Mexican cheese, and they made a bunch of little quesadillas to go along with these little steak strips. So you could just open up your little quesadilla, plop a couple steak cuts in there, and you had these little steak and cheese tacos. And it was, we had 23 people over with music and bean bags and... It was great. It one-upped Steak Night 1. Steak Night 1 was great, but Steak Night 2, just the way that whole porch set up, it was like perfect for hosting. And Simon bought these really nice candles that he got to use.
Oh, shout out to the candles.
Shout out to the candles from the farmstead. Were they from the farmstead, I imagine?
They were.
They looked like corn kernels.
I still have them too. We're going to use them here again.
You want to guess how much they were, each one?
Let me think. What's a Simon amount to spend on candles? I'm going to say like $25 each.
That's very close.
Very close. It was like 22, wasn't it?
Something like that. But I mean, I used them in two of my videos already.
So it's worth it.
It already paid for itself. And I'm going to use them again
tax
here.
Tax write off.
Continuity is the word.
Or continuity.
Continuity.
That's what I was trying to say. Yes.
We only have two Native American speakers on this podcast.
That's right.
Native English speakers.
And then, as far as the tournament, Well, for me, basically on the competitive side, I'll just get it out of the way. I mean, the SI joint is just taking its time. I'm not playing this week. I didn't play last week. It's definitely getting way better, but I definitely gave it a decent little tweak down in Florida. So it's on the mend, but this is a really intense lifestyle out here when you're on the road. So it's not as recovery is not as plentiful as you might think, especially when you're me. And your Monday and Tuesday every week consists of checking out of the Airbnb, driving to the new place, filming 3 practice rounds in 2 days, grocery shopping for the week, and checking into the next Airbnb. So that can be a lot on the body.
It's a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Joey's room right now, and he's got bags on bags on bags on bags. So he's carrying up and down the stairs and loading him into his car. I mean, I just know going to the airport, like getting my 50-pound bag into the trunk. I mean, he's doing that 5-6 times what I do. So it's like, it's a lot of moving things, and you're doing everything business as usual other than playing disc golf right now.
Yep. And that's the beauty of having basically a media company and having these clients. I mean, that's the reason that I can be on the road is because of the media work that I do, or at least the reason that I can be on the road without losing thousands of dollars every month. And so the playing is sort of like the prize for all of this other work that I'm doing. And it doesn't feel like work when I get to play on the side. And so, yeah, I mean, basically it is business as usual. And it's also good for the throwing temptation, which doesn't really exist with this particular injury because it's basically impossible to throw accurately or like be interested in throwing when it's in pain. But it's also been like, I'm busy. I don't have a bunch of sitting around to do and thinking about like, oh, I wish I could be playing. So that's always a nice element to it. And yeah, it just keeps me occupied. And then obviously, you know, Maria's played last week, and she she's playing this week. Last week was her first MVP rounds, essentially.
Spicy news.
Yeah, spicy
new
news.
New teammate. Maria Liivamaagi.
From Tallinn, well, technically Sadala, Estonia, but I guess she would say Tallinn now. That's where she has her apartment. But yeah, I was really impressed with her. She averaged, I think she averaged 25 or 30 points above her rating for the weekend, and at least 70% of her bag showed up the night before. So she had like 3 throws with most of the discs in her bag and then went out and played the beast. And I would say she punched way out of her weight class for basically not having played all off season, and new sponsor, new discs coming out of the winter wonderland into the warmth. And that's always a tricky transition, as we saw with me. She gets a little more pain kind of in the front side of her body, like up in the chest, right? Kind of where the shoulder meets your chest. Basically, that's where, because she throws basically all forehand. So that's like the spot that we always watch. And yeah, last year it was really bothering her at Austin because she ramped up too fast, but she did a really good job of coming in, knowing that she needed to play, but also knowing that she couldn't overplay before the tournament started because she has 7 sanctioned rounds in 2 weeks plus a bunch of practice. So far she is healthy and uninjured, and I'm glad to be a caddy and a support system, as well as just it gives me extra time to really be on top of all the rest of my media stuff, so It's been fine. Obviously, like, I'm frustrated when it continues to hurt, but Seth Muncy is going to be here tomorrow, so I'm looking forward to talking with him. And yeah, it's definitely feeling better. But yeah, Simon Lizotte, I would say you officially conquered your Waco fear.
Yeah, the whole week was the theme because we're doing the YouTube series, and of course you want to try to build some kind of storyline for the week and talk about your hopes and dreams and goals and struggles a bit, just to, you know, make it somewhat coherent for the watchers. And my history at the Beast, I mean, we talked about it before the event, is not the greatest. So I've never really played well on that course. Never really understood why, because I technically like it. And yeah, I've just had in Waco in general, just kind of weird experiences, and was a bit scared of what was going to happen, if it was just going to be another kind of demoralizing event for me, which early in the season, you know, no one can really use that. But practice went pretty well. I think I shot a 14 under in the second practice round. We had perfect conditions in the practice, and then tournament conditions obviously were completely different and pretty wild. And the tournament started out kind of as usual, where I was playing all right, but not really scoring. And I was like in 40 something, 44th place or something after round one. And I was like, okay, here we go. It's just another typical Waco. At least I'm still in the cash line. So maybe this video series is going to be about fighting to make cash in Texas. But round two kind of turned everything around, and I was able to shoot my first hot round of the year, which was really nice. In pretty crazy conditions, a 12 down felt pretty solid. I think it was like 1080 something rated. So safe to say, very good round. And that almost jumped me all the way to lead card. I did like a 36 person jump on the leader board, which was just wild. Found myself on top of chase card, and final round was one of the craziest rounds I've ever played. Not really because I played so great or because so many crazy things happened. It was just because looking at the leaderboard, I think I started checking, I think during or after hole nine, I started basically every like 15 minutes looking at the leaderboard, and I have never seen anything like it. Like, I don't know if it was the conditions or just the level of play on tour now, but there were literally 20 players within four strokes at some point. Like, almost the entire back nine, you just had no clue where you were going to end up. Like, if you were going to birdie out, you might be in the top five. If you were going to par out, you might be in 30th place. Like, it was just so crazy to think, like, that you put so much time and preparation into playing this event, and then it all comes down to like the last 30 minutes of if you're going to make good shots or bad shots, and it'll change like your entire perspective of the event. And it seems like so little things that it comes down to at the end. Like, I mean, if I go bogey bogey in the last two holes instead of birdie birdie, the whole story of the whole week would have been completely different. And the difference would have been maybe like one or two worse shots.
Yep.
And it's just crazy how, looking at the whole tournament now, yeah, I played a great tournament. I got second place. That's pretty amazing for my history on that course and at that event. But in a blink of an eye, even like in the last two holes, it could have been so different, and I could have been like 25th, and it just would have been like, oh yeah, I was right there, and I kind of just like fell apart at the end. But you know, it was still a good event. It's just crazy how nuanced this game can feel, even though you're spending multiple days there. And at the end of it, it comes down to like just 15 minutes of you got it or you don't. And in this case, I did. Almost thought I was going to go into a playoff. I'm not entirely sure if I was mentally ready. Physically, I felt all right. But man, I was stressed those last holes down the stretch. The heart rate was up, you know, when you get this like weird feeling, almost like really uncomfortable feeling where you're just like, oh, you just want this to end.
Yeah.
And I really tried like to feel the feelings and like embrace them a bit and just be like, oh, this is like great. Like, this is why we play. Just like feel this, these nerves and this excitement. But sometimes it's like just so on like the uncomfortable side.
It feels like you're about to throw up sometimes.
It just feels like you just want it to end. Just want to feel relieved, no matter good or like if it goes good, that's a nice relief. If it goes bad, at least it's still a relief of this stress you're feeling.
I mean, you said yourself on your vlog that, or maybe it wasn't on the vlog, but I heard you say you were glad it didn't go to a playoff.
Well, I said I'm half glad.
Yeah.
Because I'm done with the stress. But I'm also obviously half sad because it would have made for a great story.
You could have won.
You could have won.
Yeah, I think my history in playoffs is pretty good. So,
well, it's interesting to see this.
I don't know. If I would have won this tournament, it would have just added another one to the list of my wins where I was just like, I couldn't explain how I won the tournament. Like, it wouldn't have made any sense. Like, I was not in contention to win until like literally the last two holes.
And if you had gone, like, so I'm looking at the leaderboard here. So you go into 17, you're at 27 under, you birdie to get to 29. But like you said, if you had gone bogey, that would have taken you from 27 back to 25 under, and you would have finished in 11th place, one stroke ahead of Paul Kranz in 15th. And
yeah.
I mean, you do something worse than that, and you go, maybe you finish at 24, then you're in 14th. And I mean, it just, like, it's crazy how close everybody was to the winner, which Adam finished at 30 under. So there was exactly 30 players within 10 strokes of Adam Hammes.
Jake Mon shot 15 under.
He tied the 18 under from Paul McBeth. And that happened. So my tournament experiences was that I caddied the last two rounds for Calvin Heimberg, who was the leader after day two, and he was like one off the lead after day one. I run his Instagram account, and if I'm ever not playing and he's playing, I always try to go out and get some extra clips. And obviously he's a really good friend of mine. And usually I used to just walk with him, because he's pretty particular about wanting to carry his own bag. So I really never push that. And I'm just there as like with his caddy badge separated and just filming shots. But, recently, I suppose maybe a little bit before this year, maybe at the end of last year, he started to kind of open up a lot more to the bag carrying element, which really surprised me. So he, like, second round, he just gave me the bag right away, and I was like, wow. I mean, I'm not used to that from him. So I carried the bag the last two rounds, and man, I mean, you can tell that he put in some putting practice this off season because it is different. It's not just that he's making them, it's like the way that he, like, the body language over those putts. Second round he made a lot of 35 45 footers that I was really impressed with. That's usually his shortcoming when it comes to those things, but his other shortcoming is his forehand, and it's been a roller coaster of a skill for him over the last few years. You know, I would say 3 or 4 years ago, it was really not a shot that he used very often. And his close friend, Zach Melton, started encouraging him to throw more of those shots and started encouraging him to try to use it. And he implemented that a lot more towards the end of 2023, going into 2024. But the problem is that when you add in a skill like that, but you don't do the proper conditioning or the proper strength work to stabilize those muscles, especially when it's forehand, you can run into injury problems, which is exactly what happened to him. He threw a lot of hard forehands, and his elbow started to not like it. And, I mean, he dropped out of Waco last year, and he basically spent the entire rest of the season throwing backhand only, no forehands, and then this winter did a bunch of PT and is throwing pain-free sidearms. The main issue is, in my eyes as a caddy, is that in practice, he throws them all the time. Like, you're throwing multiple shots, like, you're messing around, and that's a skill that he's working on, so he's, like, always trying to throw them where he can. In tournaments, not so much. Like, you go to what your strengths are, even if you're practicing a new skill. Like, you're not, like, let's say you're practicing a spin putt, but you're a push putter. Like, you're not gonna just, like, go straight into spin putting, like, the entire tournament just because you were practicing it. So, outside of hole six and 12. Those are the only two forehands that he's throwing, and they're pretty soft, like little get around the corner forehands. And 17 bit him both of the last 2 days. He got super. He thinks it's maybe the luckiest shot he's ever thrown on 17 in day two, because he early released his forehand and essentially split those trees and then skipped and cut the corner on the skip. So he like went inside that corner tree and then like passed all the rocks down, and he had just like a little putter in for the birdie. And then the last day didn't happen well. It's basically, if he is gonna mess up a forehand, it's because he doesn't stay down on his front knee, and he straightens his legs, which doesn't allow his hips to finish the swing. And so he basically stands up, and that causes like an early release. And he called it right off his tee shot on 17. He walked back and he goes, "I didn't stay down on it." So he knows what's going on, and it's just a skill that, you know, he's still working on. And when that skill is going to get exposed the most is in the high pressure moments when you need it to work. Going into hole 16, it was his tournament to lose. I mean, there was nobody else. He had the cards. If he had birdied 16 and 17 or 16, I mean, he was one up on Adam, and he threw a beautiful, beautiful drive on 16, right where he wanted to. And he pulled his upshot barely and hit that one tree on the way in, which, I mean, he admitted right away it wasn't bad luck, because he was aiming to go 20 feet left. So he pulled his line by 15 feet and hit that one tree that's in the way, and left him at whatever, 65, and Adam birdied, and then they were tied, and Adam put a nice forehand out there with the box, and Calvin threw it OB early. And I mean, at that point, if you don't have a thumber or some big over the top shot, or that, I don't know if you guys remember Paul McBeth throwing that really crazy inside high forehand like 3 or 4 years ago that got on Jomez, where he was short of the corner and went like super aggressive, and that's essentially the shot Calvin was trying to pull off. But I would say if he's not good at forehands, the one thing he's less good at is spike forehands, like low to high forehands. Like his comfort forehand is like a high to low, or like a flat shot, like a hole 12's tee shot. So those high spiking forehands where you got to start low and finish high, that's like, I mean, that's hard for me as well. I think that's hard for a lot of people who don't throw consistent forehands. So yeah, that bit him, triple bogey. And at that point you're out of the tournament. But, yeah, it was a really, really fascinating final round. It felt like at points I kind of forgot that Adam was like even still there, because he had some holes where he parred, but it just felt like there's no way that he's still here in contention. And then I looked at the scores on 13 and I was like, holy cow, it's all right. Everybody's right here. And
yeah, for a while it was crazy because he had a 5-hole par streak in the middle of his round, which
I thought that wrote him off.
Speaking just from a viewer's perspective, because I just watched, the lead changes were insane the final round, and there was people popping up on the leaderboard that you didn't even think were there.
Evan Scott,
Greg Barsby, Nicolò Castro, Grady Shue. There were so many people within just a few strokes, and if they had just a few things go their way, then it could have been like a 10-way playoff almost. But it was wild. And I would say this brings in the question, how many events of those should we play a year? Because from a viewer's perspective, I always think it's interesting for people to say that they want to see people struggle and their B score separation. I thought this was probably one of the most exciting tournaments that I've watched in a long time, just for the fact it was anybody's game. And I actually prefer watching tournaments like Waco.
Just
because you have no idea what's going to happen. It literally was a nail biter down the stretch. And I think Waco is kind of the only event we play like that on tour. Like maybe Preserve, GMC's getting to that point. Idlewild is getting a little bit easier.
Well, and Idlewild has just provided those. I would say Idlewild is shreddable. It's still hard, but if you're on, I mean, especially because 16 is so eagleable. Like, that's where I think that, I mean, I remember my most memorable watching experiences of excitement come from a couple final rounds at Idaho. I mean, you won off Chase Card.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there was the one year that Kyle and Marweed went to the playoff, but that year there was like there seven were, guys
there
who
was
could
a
have
chance
all done
for like
it.
A three or four way playoff.
Oh yeah, it was huge. And then they both birdied 18 to essentially make it a two way. But if they had parred, then it would have been five or six or four guys in that playoff. So there are some courses. I suppose Maple Hill isn't all that dissimilar, and maybe GMC has its moments.
GMC is the closest other course I feel like we have to Waco, because it really is a shred fest at this point. Brewster, you got to be on point, and Fox Run. I mean, Fox Run, when it's calm, it's like you got to be shooting 12 under or better to be in contention.
Well, that brings in my last little question, which is basically in the second round, on the final hole, we had ripping tailwind for the lead card. And so Adam basically says on the tee that he's going to throw an Onyx, a 10 speed, because of this tailwind. And it's just, when it gets in a tailwind on 18, it's like the opposite problem you have in a headwind. A headwind, you're not sure if you can make it. In a tailwind, you're trying to stick it if you're a big power thrower. Like, it's the trouble is to get it to not go long once you throw it that hard. Like, how do you slow it down? Calvin basically countered it by going really low, and it ended up working out. But Adam disced down, and it was pretty unfortunate for him, honestly. Right when he threw, the wind just stopped. And so, like, out of his hand, he's, like, expecting some lifts, and it just doesn't do anything. And I'm like thinking, oh no. And so is everybody else. And so is he. Like, oh, he's short. And it spikes and digs like right in. I'm sure everybody who's listening, or most people who are listening, have seen the picture. Spikes right in on the line. And off the tee, everybody's like, that didn't cross. Like, and like by seeing where it is, because it didn't go in the water, it just stuck right there. And so Adam's like basically walking down to take his provisional or his next shot, and the catch cam from across, like, he gets, first of all, he gets the green or like the X or whatever, and then the catch cam from across the water is like, dude, it's safe by like an inch or whatever. And so that essentially caused Adam to not feel like he needed to take a provisional and like do the walk around. And so we went out there and we looked, and boy, I mean, it was the discussion. I mean, they had the mics on, so if anybody was like watching DGN, I'm sure they heard the same thing I did. But essentially, Chris Dickerson looked at it and said that, you know, based on the intent of the line, it would be out of bounds. And Adam, honestly, like, props to Adam. The first thing he says, he goes in and looks, he goes, dang, that's really close. And then he looks at the other three guys and he goes, this is not my call. This is you guys. Like, I'm going to remove myself. And that's what you should do, in my opinion, in that situation, unless you're needed to be like the fourth. And so he like steps away, and it's, who is it? Calvin, Chris, and I don't know who the fourth guy was. Wow. I feel bad now. Anyway, they're all looking at it, and essentially why it got changed, or not changed, but I felt like at the beginning of the discussion, it was going to be called out based on the first things that Chris said, which was that the intent of the line would state that it's out of bounds. The next section of the discussion came from Calvin, where he basically said that it wasn't defined enough because of the way that it was these blades of grass, and it wasn't like this in that spot. It wasn't like as solid of a line as it could have been. And they basically kind of gave like tie goes to the runner, but they called it in, and that ended up keeping Adam on lead card instead of you, Simon, for the final round. So it was an interesting moment. I think it's a moment that should be looked at, and I think that the DGPT, I mean, in my opinion, the easiest fix there is you string it like at Crokel. Like, you play Crokel. There will never be a debate like that at Crokel because of the way that they string the OB. I think when you have those big, thick, painted lines and you're not painting on dirt. You're painting on these movable blades of grass. And so, like, it literally comes down to, where are these blades of grass with white paint existing? And it, did they get moved by the disc hitting them? Did they get moved by the wind? I mean, it's not like a set in stone line like a string is. And I think it essentially brought that to light. And it also brought to light that, in my eyes, I think before the season starts, there needs to be like one little 2-hour little rules clinic from the tour to the players, so that everybody is like on the same page about like going through a series of very controversial simulated situations and listening to the staff and the players sort of decide like how these things should be called. Because I think there's a lot of disagreements on that particular moment. And yeah, I think that it just highlights the fact that we need a more clear-cut way to define that. Obviously, I think string line is the easiest fix here, but I want to not leave it on that, but essentially that's how it was called, and Adam stayed on the lead card. And then on 18, I mean, what a clutch way to win. It was so cool. He admitted in the interview that it was a little low out of his hand, and it got a little lift, as he claimed. I watched it on the video. It didn't look like a lift. It just looked like it didn't drop quite as fast as it normally would have. And sick putt. And did you see Gannon's little video where he like asked? It was like he asked Nico and himself and like two other guys as they were right before Adam teed off, like their predictions. And I think Nico called it perfect, where he said he was going to go like 35 long and make the putt. And it was sweet. It's just how you want disc golf tournaments to be won, right? I mean, you want it to be won the same way that when you beat me for the first game in table tennis last night, you said you would have rather won off of like your, like a win, like a winner, as they say in tennis, versus like me messing up. And Adam won that tournament. Like, he took it and he won it. And I thought it was so cool. And I'm just happy for him. He is just one of my favorite people. I really resonate with him. He's a fellow Midwesterner, and I've known him since I was maybe 16 years old. And I think we've both matured a lot since we first met. And it's just cool to talk with him now, and both of us know like kind of what we used to be like. And it's cool to see. It's cool to see him as a 4-time Elite Series champion. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, one of the 5-time,
I think.
No, because that Masters Cup was a national tour.
National tour is not Elite Series?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I guess it is. So he is 5-time?
I think he's 5-time.
Wait, okay, so we've got Maple Hill.
Portland.
Santa Cruz, and this.
So the 4-time.
So it's 4-time. He won the Silver Series that Jeff Korns ran, didn't he? The Resistance. So that would be a Silver Series. I think that's his 4 wins right there. But it was cool because he was wearing his Packer-themed Discraft jersey, and I didn't realize it till the very end that the number 3 on the back was because of his wins, his Elite Series wins. I didn't know that. I thought it was in tribute to some Packer legend that he loves that wore number 3.
Yeah, one of the reasons my last putt really like psyched me out and I got like really nervous is because I was thinking about all the fans watching, and like regardless who you were pulling for, me or Adam, because at that time I think it was only me or Adam who could have won on the last hole, because you know I'm a sports fan. You want exciting finishes, and I started thinking about the coverage, and I was like, damn, every sports fan wants me to make this putt just so the finish can't be Adam laying up for par and yep. winning. So I was like, oh God, I have a freaking 20-footer, bit of wind, and everyone watching wants me to make it just so Adam has to win it on the last hole and can't just like play it safe and win it.
When he was also watching too, we're all on the tee waiting, looking yeah. down at you guys. So he knows exactly what's going on. He's watching you make the putt. And when you made it, I heard him just deep breath in, deep breath out, like, all right, like, I know what I got to do. I got to birdie this if I want to win.
Yeah, I just knew for the tournament and the fans, like me making that putt was going to make everyone enjoy those last moments even more. So, yeah.
Were you shaky on the last putt?
Yeah, I was freaking out. I was so happy.
How did it come out of your hand? Was it clean?
It was a little fluffy. It was a little nose up. It was a little right, but it was good enough.
For putts like that, what do you do? Do you take less time or more time?
I think normal time. I don't take that much time putting anyway. It's like 5 seconds or something. Mm-hmm. So I stick to my routine and
you try to make it as normal as you can.
Yeah. I mean, unless the wind is doing something funky, I think I would do normal routine. Probably the thoughts in my head are going to be slightly different, but I think time wise similar. I did a lot of self-talk that final round. Like, you know, when you play with Aaron Gossett, for example, you like literally yes. hear him self-talking, like, He pumps himself up before almost every shot. Like, come on, man. Like, you got this. Like, commit. Or, like, he just talks about stuff like that. And down the stretch that round, I did a lot of that. I would be, like, whispering to myself, like, come on, dude. Like, you just give this a chance. Like, don't be scared. Stuff along those lines. And I would repeat to myself in my head that, like, dude, putting's so easy. Like, just, like, step up, make it, throw it in. Like, the worst thing about missing is if you feel like you had the wrong intentions or thoughts before the putt. So I really made sure that at least if I was going to miss, at least I tried my best to
be prepared,
have the right thoughts.
You set yourself up for success the best you could.
I think Correct. Also, I never really answered your question, Eagle, of how many of these should we see on tour. I mean, I think it's more fun. And I think the most common question amongst pros last week was, well, there was the pros who like Waco and the pros who hate Waco. So there's the pros who like Waco who are asking, like, you know, are we going to keep coming back here? And there are the pros who hate Waco who are saying, like, when are we going to stop? When are we not going to be at Waco? And I'm in camp number one. I hope we continue to go to Waco every year because I think that the course is so unique as far as the skills that it tests of the players, and obviously the mental aspect of the finish is really stressful. And I think, man, just give me a set of clippers to go through and trim up some of the Twizzlers in the woods, and it's perfect for the opening of the season. Now, if I had had it my way, I would have scheduled these in reverse, because I don't think going from a 3-day event into essentially like
a major
in Elite Plus with two courses to practice, including one that has significant changes, even the one property that we've played has significant changes, and the other property we've never played. And that seems like a lot to ask of a bunch of players to drive down and learn two courses for a major, not a major, but Elite Plus. So
two courses in 3 days of practice.
Not good.
No.
And I think
Monday should be a day off, ideally.
Right. No. So I just, like, if we had gone the other way around and gone up to Waco,
much better.
Well, and then Monday you can take off and everybody knows the beast. Yeah, the beauty.
It would,
like,
start on Friday. You honestly could take Monday.
You could take two practice rounds between Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You could just play twice.
Yeah.
And you would need about 5 minutes to learn the two new changes on the holes. I just feel like that was a big whiff on the Disc Golf Pro Tour's end by not switching these around.
The Pro Tour needs to set the players up for as much success as possible in terms of longevity.
I mean, my hot take of this episode is that we should have Eagle McMahon do the 2026 schedule in exchange for a free tour card.
One can dream.
Well, the good thing is that this is the only back-to-back the tour has this year, at least Elite Series, other than Ledgestone and Idlewild.
There's some in Europe.
Yeah, I'm not counting Europe because that's different.
Okay.
That's fair. Yeah.
Anyone that goes to Europe from America is, I mean, they're on like vacation kind of anyway. Like,
well, and also you can't we saw with Kono Pichte and Ale, now that's an extreme amount of time to put in between events, but you can't throw too many off weeks in there before you stop incentivizing people to go. So
all of a sudden everything's like an hour away from one place to the next.
Well, but that then would disregard our point here because this was an hour and 40 minutes from Waco.
I mean, the back to back is PCS to Crokul and then Crokul to Tallinn,
which is the major.
Which, I mean, PCS to Crokul, that's like, it's kind of far.
Well, I mean, if you get on a plane, it's a 2-hour flight. But yeah, if you're driving, that's a whole other beast. I've done that drive.
And then Tallinn's actually one of the more difficult airports in Europe to fly into, especially coming. I don't even know if there's direct flights from Norway to.
No, Tallinn. You have. So in order to get into Tallinn, you have to go through either Helsinki, which is the capital of Finland, or Riga, which is the capital of Latvia.
Or Germany.
So there's not a lot of big airports that you can jump to get in. I mean, it's a tiny airport. So
Amsterdam would do it too, probably.
I think Amsterdam, at least the planes I've scheduled for Maria from Amsterdam, she had to go to Riga and then to Tallinn.
Wow.
But I'm not sure if that's how it goes. We'll see. But you aren't playing PCS or Crokul, and neither are you.
Nope.
So you're going to Italy and then
I'm getting to Tallinn on like Friday or Saturday before the event.
And you are figuring your plans out still, or do you have tickets?
I still don't have a passport.
Oh.
Yeah, my German passport's been expired for years. I don't know how that happened, but it did. And my Canadian passport expires this April. I sent it in to Canada to get it renewed in November. Like a month later, I got it sent back because my new passport photo wasn't signed by the photographer or something. There's all these laws and rules that make it just hard on people. Probably for a good reason. I'm just not aware.
And then I sent
it back with new photos that were then dated and signed by the photographer. And I sent those in like, at this point, it's been like 2 months probably. So I don't know how long this process will take. I don't know when I get my passport back, but I'm waiting until then. I have like 3 months or 4 months before the trip. So
what about your German passport? Is that renewable?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I have to be in Germany for that or how I would even start that process. It's not that easy.
You need a passport to get to Germany.
I do need a passport.
Yeah.
And what's the...
good point.
What's the... process for you to get an American passport ever?
Well, I would have to become an American citizen.
Okay. And right now you're a resident.
Well, I just got my green card.
Yeah, so you're a resident.
I think after 2 years, or is it 3 years of holding a green card, I can apply for citizenship. But that will take a lot of paperwork, and then you got to do all these things you got to do to become a citizen.
So maybe when Emmy's in like middle school.
Well, I am pretty certain that I will never become an American citizen.
Uh-huh.
The only reason I'm contemplating it is to play for Team USA on the President's Cup.
You want to be a winner?
I mean, I just think I would be the only person in history to be able to do that. And who would actually do it just like for the fun of it.
Tony Farrow could do it. He could play. He could play on Team
Europe. He wouldn't make the team. I don't even know if I would ever qualify for Team USA because there's so many people above me. But maybe I could win like a captain's choice or a fan vote. I don't even know how that works.
So come on, you gotta always play for Team Europe. You can't be a traitor.
I know. There's that thought.
What
but
if it's the first year that you play for Team USA is the year that Team Europe wins?
I know. That's maybe. I'm going to do like an inside job where I switch to Team USA and then just sabotage the whole thing.
Oh my
gosh. So Team Europe finally wins. So I'm actually still, of course, in heart Team Europe. I just, you know, I'll play the role.
And
that's my master plan for my end of my career. That's how I'm going to go out.
That's how you're going to go out.
I'm going to make Europe win by just sabotaging Team America.
You're going to have a 20 footer for the win and you're just going to chuck it 90 degrees to the right.
That's a good podcast name. Sabotage.
Sabotage for the win. My podcast name at the moment is Scorpion Palace.
Ooh.
Because you said that earlier. But this year, President's Cup for the first time is going to be on American soil.
I just got the text yesterday.
Yeah.
That I made Team Europe.
Oh my gosh.
So I need to answer that actually and confirm that I want to play.
Yeah, it's going to be in Stockton. We just got our OTB, I guess it's Champions Cup edition discs.
Let's do our due diligence as Team MVP players and review the new Champions Cup releases. I have them here on my lap. First, we have a Prism Proton Soft Pyro. We got a guy with candles on his head, as well as a volcano.
We called him the psychedelic bass player.
Yeah, it feels pretty good. This one actually has just like a teeny bit of dome, but if you like the feel of a pyro, you're really going to like the feel of this. We have a return. The first re-release, Prism Proton Soft Envy. We got the snail with the balloon carrying it. We have a new Particle Glow Proton Virus. And there seems to be this lady in a hazmat suit.
Wait, lady?
Yeah.
You think it's a lady?
Yeah, it's clearly a lady.
Oh, yeah, it's a lady. I will say, this is my side note right away. When we say Particle Glow, you don't need to say the Proton because it's like saying Metal Flake Champion. You just say Metal Flake Max because Metal Flake implies that it's in.
There's Metal Flake Star.
Yeah, but there's not Particle Neutron yet.
There might be.
If there ever is, then I'll go back on my statement.
Next, we have a Prism Proton
Crave
with some meerkats with disc golf bags.
150 class.
These feel actually really good. I kind of wish that they made some in heavier weights because they feel really nice. Probably my favorite release is the Particle Hex.
You said Particle Glow Hex.
That stamp for some reason reminds me of your thrill stamp a bit. Or is it completely different?
It's pretty different.
Oh, okay.
We have a Gandalf type figure on.
Oh, that's
stand.
A good.
No, it's Zeus.
Zeus.
Who is
Gandalf's kind of like Zeus.
They both
Gandalf's
apply.
Gandalf's kind of like Zeus. That's the podcast name.
Or Gandalf's kind of like Zeus.
Maybe more Dumbledore.
Ooh.
Dumbledore, Gandalf, Zeus. It doesn't matter. Mike Insho design. This feels really good. My gut is telling me that it might be a little bit more overstable for hexes, but we need to go out and throw it. Proton Soft Range with isopods crawling all over crystals. You know, there's... speaking of isopods...
What did you call it?
Yeah. Centipede.
A centipede. And I called it a grub, and you had the right name.
It's definitely an isopod.
So there's actually so many isopods outside.
Yes.
Like, I was making breakfast on the driveway. I'm parked in the driveway of my van. And probably the most isopods I've ever seen in one place. They were everywhere.
Do you think they're scorpion snacks? Like, what do you think scorpions go after?
Isopods, probably.
Probably isopods.
Isopods cannibalize themselves. So.
Really?
They do. Ratana, she's going to hate me so much for saying this. She collected isopods for a period of time and kept them as pets. Unfortunately, they all died.
Because they ate each other?
They didn't eat each other.
Oh.
She just didn't open the lid. So
she found non-cannibalizing isopods?
They never got a chance to eat each other. Let's just put it that way. And lastly, we have a Prism Proton Defy in lightweight. This is a pretty cool stamp.
I kind of wish that one was max weight because I think I would bag it if it was.
Yeah, you were a Defy guy for a period of time, right?
I am a Defy guy.
Do you have one in the back?
No, I don't. But I identify as one. I'm a Defy guy. That's the podcast name.
I'm a Defy guy.
Well, just to cap off our Waco recap, which we tangented away from, just to give the updated fantasy points standings, In third place, we have Eagle with 877.17 points. Obviously, Eagle didn't play last week, and he's on his own team, so that's part of it. In second place, myself, 909.17. My FPO was really, really big. Kristen came back and won, so that's huge. I'm feeling good about that. And then still in a distant first place because, I mean, he's got 2 and 3 in the FPO point standings, as well as a lot of good MPO.
Himself
included, who is in second place. Simon in the lead with 1,107 points. And I want to give a little shout out and potentially a favor ask to Jeremiah, who commented on episode 9 with the updated points. I want to ask Jeremiah if he is interested in doing the math after Sunday of each Pro Tour and DMing me so I don't have to do the math. I will basically call them the Jeremiah point updates or point updates from Jeremiah. And you'll get a little shout out every time we do point updates. So that's
this is
my,
your big chance, this Jeremiah.
This is your chance, Jeremiah, if you want to.
On the 36th biggest sports podcast?
Yeah, 38th biggest sports. Well, it might have changed by now. But oof. When I saw it after our last episode released like 10 days ago, we were number 38 in the U.S. for sports podcasts, which I don't know exactly what that means.
It means we're a big deal.
It means we're 37 away from the top.
That's right. So I'm still feeling good. I'm not sure how I feel still about my Ezra Robinson choice because he played good again. And I imagine he's going to play good this week as well. But Anthony also performed well, so it's a mixed bag for me when I look at my Ezra versus AB choice there.
I think it's a good choice.
You have Isaac, right?
No, I have Isaac, AB, and Niklas.
Oh.
Yeah.
No one has Ezra.
No one has Ezra.
That was definitely
I drafted Ezra.
Blunder on our,
well, I drafted him.
I know.
So I had him, and then you had too many guys, so you dropped AB, and I picked him up for Ezra, which... Sorry, Niklas, I probably should have. Well, we'll see. We'll see how it shapes out. We got a bunch of events this year.
We got the returning champ this week.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the course this week. The courses,
wait,
the place.
Does Simon need to whine?
Do you want
to
whine first? You can whine, and then we'll talk about Austin.
All right. Do we want a long whine or a short whine? We want a short whine.
We want just a little cup of wine.
Simon. Okay, let me go with this one. Not disc golf related, just a casual whine about being an adult. This one's about mail and emails. So, you know, everyone that has a house has a mailbox. Everyone in general has a mailbox, actually. And every time you open your mailbox, I don't know, maybe like every other day, every day, once a week, whatever your rhythm is, you pull out mail. And first of all, why is mail 99% of the time bad? Like, it's always bad news. Like, is there ever you open a mail and you're like, oh, this is awesome. Like, that almost never happens. So that's my first one.
Oh,
second
my
one.
Gosh. The IRS is going to pay me?
Well, taxes is a whole different wine. But, and 80% of mail you get go straight into the trash without even opening it because it's some kind of weird ads or scam or... Like, how is that legal? The waste of paper and ink in the mail system is unbelievable. Like, how is this not a problem in the world? Like, what are we doing?
It's a huge problem.
Like, the amount of mail that goes straight from my mailbox into the recycling bin is unbelievable.
At least it's a recycling bin, huh?
I mean, sure, but we don't even know what the hell happens at the recycling factories.
Sure.
Like, isn't that a huge controversial thing as well? So, okay, and then going over to email, how is it, like, the amount of times I've hit unsubscribe on random emails, I don't even know how they ended up in my folder, and still they keep popping up a week later. Then I hit unsubscribe again, and it's, like, impossible to get out of these weird... systems.
Your data was compromised.
I get 40 emails a day, and 35 of them are completely useless, and I don't know why I get them. I don't know how I get them. I don't know how to get rid of them. And that must be a huge... I don't know really how data works in this world, but I heard it's also an issue that the amount of emails that are completely useless, I mean, the amount of data that is, that's probably some sort of pollution as well in the world, right?
I think so.
Do you know how data works, Joey?
Yeah, well, I mean, it just depends like what you choose to do with it. Now, the internet is infinitely large, I think. Mm-hmm. That, correct me if I'm wrong in the comments, please. But from what I understand, like the cloud is, I mean, there are massive centers all over the world that are basically like way ahead of what we can possibly take up in digital capacity. I mean, I have a Gmail, and in Gmail, you can create like a bunch of different inbox folders. So I have like primary, promotions, social, and updates. And so I like sift, I like, you can select where you want them all to go. And so for me, well, first of all, yeah, the unsubscribe thing, I mean, I do the same. And some of them work and some of them don't. Eagle's got something on the right track of your data being compromised. If you're not sponsored,
I actually signed up for a service called Incogni. I don't know if you've seen certain people talk about it. What it does is you give them permission to send all the people who have your data, whether it be different companies, services, and whatnot, to pull your data from their databases. And ever since I have done that, I've been getting less spam emails and even spam calls, because I think when you start the service with them, you put in the emails that you have that you want them to service, and I even think you put your phone number, and I've noticed that my inbox has been way cleaner lately.
Wow. So, I'd like to try that.
I'm just saying, why can't the government make a law say that just like puts the hammer down, like, no more freaking spam mail, no more freaking spam email, and if you do it, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah,
like,
but
in
see,
serious
you,
trouble.
You come from a part of the world where the government controls big private corporations, and we live in a part of the world where the government is controlled by big private corporations. Like, every single one of those people who could make that rule change are getting campaign contributions from the exact big corporations that want to send you all those emails. I mean, that is the epicenter of the corruption in this country, is that we say that we're a democracy and we're really just a capitalist oligarchy run by gigantic corporations. I mean, that is what it is. And if anybody...
I don't know what that means at all.
An oligarchy?
Yeah.
An oligarchy,
right, this is not a political podcast.
Let's not get too deep into it.
What is on the docket for the Open at Austin? We are playing two courses.
Switch. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to...
I agree with Simon. The spam, both in physical and email, is it's astounding.
Yeah. And the way I sort my emails out, I only get notifications from primary emails that come through. So all of my spam stuff or all those things, like, they do exist in my email, but they go into a folder that I never even look at. So I'm curious. I want to try your thing out. That sounds really interesting.
I found it to be helpful.
Yeah.
It's like a monthly subscription, but I did like 1 month and I feel like it cleared up a lot of spam for me. So I recommend it. Maybe it'll be a future sponsor on the podcast.
I do think maybe in Europe it would be different, like with those types of spam laws, that like a government in a country would have some control over enacting that. But in this country, I don't think that would happen.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, Open at Austin.
Open at Austin.
I mean, first of all, this is a city that means a lot to you, Eagle, and it means a lot to me. Austin is one of my favorite cities in the world, and it's funny, the courses that we're playing, because the first 6 or 7 times I came to Austin, it was for the disc golf that we're not playing this week, like Roy G., Met Center, Marymore Seawright, Zilker, Circle C, OSP, Bartholomew. There's so many fantastic disc golf courses. In my eyes, the best disc golf metro areas in the country goes Charlotte at number one, Minneapolis and St. Paul at number two, and Austin, Texas at number three. And I think you could argue that Austin's number two simply because the weather is favorable all year round, whereas Minneapolis, I think the courses are better. That's obviously a huge home state bias, but we only can play them, you know, from March until October or November. So just fantastic disc golf. And then also, I think Austin really lines up with a lot of the things that you and I like, which is good food and green spaces and lots of awesome restaurants. And did you go to Barton Springs yesterday?
I didn't end up going to Barton Springs. Actually went to one of my favorite spots called Casa de Luz.
Oh my God, you went there?
It's my, I absolutely love it. It is, how do you even describe Casa de Luz? It's a community center. It has a bunch of hippie establishments within it. We went there for the cafeteria that they have that's actually all vegan. And even though I'm not vegan anymore, I still absolutely love this place. It is very wholesome. It reminds me of my childhood. It smells like Palo Santo incense. And we were hanging out there. And the reason why I didn't go to Barton Springs was because right outside they had a sauna pop up. And the guy there, shout out Andres at Sweat City, I believe it to be called. He had a wood-fired sauna, cold plunge. So I did a half hour just right outside Casa de Luz, and it was great. 200-degree sauna, got in the cold plunge after. And then there was actually like this little meditation kirtan type thing from 7 to 8 that we stuck around for. And it was just, it was a great time. I feel like if you're into anything hippie, kind of new age, meditative, you definitely got to go to Casa de Luz. It is a very special community building and just vibe overall. But also went to Interstellar Barbecue a few days ago, which was incredible. It's the only Michelin star barbecue restaurant in Austin and best brisket I've had.
I got to try that. I've been to Terry.
I waited in line for an hour and a half.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not. But I went to Terry Black's in Austin last year, and then they also have a Waco location, and that's, I wouldn't say I'm the biggest barbecue guy of all time. If I go, I'm going for the brisket. But I enjoyed the Terry Black's. I'm now
it's really good.
I'm a little curious now because I think
you can't get bad barbecue in Texas.
That's fair. What, okay. Simon, when you were here last year, you had Sebastian with you.
Aww.
And you guys experienced, we're a week late this year, but last year we came here right at the exact same week as South by Southwest. And I went down to 6th Street one night with you guys, but you guys were basically non-existent to us that whole week.
Yeah, that was one of the more wild weeks of my life. I bought, I splurged, is that a word?
Oh, yeah.
I bought the music badges for the music festival, which kind of allows you to skip some lines and get into most venues pretty quickly and easily. And Sebastian, of course, one of my good friends from childhood. He's a disc golfer. He owns a bar in my hometown where I've spent many nights of my life. So he's a huge music fan as well. And of course, nightlife scene is like a big thing in his life. And yeah, we kind of just fully sent it. Like after every tournament round, after every practice round, we would go down to 6th Street and just kind of venue hop from one music event to the next. From some, we saw a couple comedy shows as well, and I think in 5 or 6 days we saw about 60 artists perform. So it was, what's the right word? Mind-blowing. And we saw, it was all artists I've never heard of before and that are like up and coming. I think that's kind of a theme for South By. But we saw some really cool bands from Korea, Japan, all across Europe, and some really small and private venues for like 20, 30 people. We were in some bigger ones where it was a couple hundred people. And definitely cool. Glad I did it. Probably wouldn't do it again. But man, the nightlife in Austin is definitely something.
I think I'll go one night down to 6th Street this week just to see what's going on. And then
South By was this past week. So, I mean, yeah. Austin's always
right. 6th
hopping.
Street will be cool no matter what, I think.
But it'll be definitely a little bit more chill.
Oh, yeah. Last week. Yeah, for sure.
Usually, we're always in Austin for the week of South By.
Yeah.
That's how the tour lines up normally.
So, the courses this week, we've got Harvey Penick Golf Campus, which is our third year playing this venue. It changed pretty significantly after year one. And then this year, I would say it changed, but not in that significant of ways. They basically just kind of made some smaller tweaks and a couple tee pad changes. What did you guys think about it? I honestly really like that course. I usually don't like ball golf courses that much on tour. But this doesn't feel like a ball golf course at all. It feels like a disc golf course on a ball golf property. There's like maybe hole 11 or whatever that big par 5 is. It feels the most kind of golfy of all of them. But everything else.
It's like a technical ball.
Oh, for sure. And it's a great, you should have to open up on some shots. But they took out the OB in the woods, which was a big point of contention for a lot of pros, and they cleaned up a lot. I mean, it's cleaner. Those lines in there are cleaner than most lines in Waco, in my opinion. And I really think it's a great, great place to play.
I would tend to agree. I don't really have any major red flags on the course, and that's usually my metric of seeing if a course is good. And I don't think there's really any blatantly bad holes out there. There's a few that, of course, I would change a little bit. But generally speaking, I think they did a really good job, really good variety. And I think it's a good track overall.
Yeah, I was really happy yesterday seeing all the changes. And I think they improved basically every hole that... Where last year I was like, damn, this hole is so close to good. If they would just trim this a little bit or like just kind of slightly go a different route with it. And they basically did all of it.
Right off the bat, hole one is new and way more dramatic. And
yeah,
hole two as well, teeing off under the bridge.
Yeah, hole one is I'm not 100% sure how I feel about hole one yet.
I don't know how I feel about hole one either.
It's a pretty brutal first shot of the day for the players out there. It's, I don't know. I think they could have made the landing zone 10 feet on each side wider. Because, yesterday I only threw one shot and I landed basically right next to the basket.
It was a good shot.
I thought it was a pretty good shot, but then still went out of bounds. And then you're faced with a 45, almost 50 foot death putt and elevated basket in the wind, and it's just like,
a bogey on hole one shouldn't ruin your day. It's very, very much in play.
Yeah, I think they could either make the landing zone a bit wider or throw from the ladies' pad, which would make you throw a mid-range, which would eliminate a little bit more of that like skip element.
I like the hole. I just don't really like it as hole one.
Sure.
I think it should be like a hole 16 or 17. Then it would be like really exciting.
It could be the last hole if you just like did it in that right order, right? If you started.
Yeah, I think last hole is 10. Like I tend to think a par 4 or 5 is good as a last hole. Just so if it's close at the end, more than one shot has to be executed to pull off the win.
That's true. I like that. That's a good note I didn't think about.
So, yeah, it's doable. UC, of course, we've played a lot of UC courses in our time, and he always liked to start with a little Island Hole par three. That used to be one of his things, just to like start it off on a, just set the tone for the pressure of the round.
You got
to
be locked in right off the bat. There's no getting away with like a little like early release or a little nerves or a bad grip or not fully locked in. I mean, you're going to be punished on that hole. And then, about 15 minutes north, we have course number 2, which is our Thursday Friday course, Sprinkle Valley at Austin Beer Works. This course was built initially for the United States Women's Disc Golf Championships. Shout out Missy Gannon. Last year, Eagle and I, we walked 4 rounds caddying for our lovely ladies, and it was great. I really thought it was a fun course. It's new. It was definitely, you know, getting broken in, getting played in. They've added a bunch of longer tees for the guys, a couple longer baskets. I would say my only kind of knock is that it feels a little repetitive, the par fours, and there's like a few holes that kind of blend together in my mind. But honestly, like, I think we would say the same thing about the Woods in Waco if we hadn't played it like 10 years in a row already. So I really think that the course is fun and unique and challenging, and the venue is fantastic with a nice brewery right at the top of the hill. You have to go right through it to get to hole 1, and also from 9 to 10 is the same walk, and they have some food trucks and nice outdoor seating. I mean, it is literally one of the best venues to come and spectate at an event, outside of the fact that the spectating on the course is a little more difficult just because of the woods, in my opinion. It's not as open as it would be at Harvey Penick. I want to know what you guys think about Sprinkle.
I think it is very Waco-like in a lot of regards. Assuming the conditions are somewhat okay, it is mostly wooded, so you are kind of protected from the wind. The trees aren't that big, so they don't really block too much of the gusts, but I think it's a course that you're going to have to be on point, because people are going to shred, because a lot of the par fours, you're throwing like putters and mids off the tee a lot of the time, and there's not a whole lot of distance, and none of the shots are really that hard per se, but you need to execute them, and then if you don't, then the rough can be pretty bad. So I'm curious to see what the field will score out there. It's going to be good because the field scores well at every event now. But the way this tournament is structured, you play 2 rounds at Sprinkle Valley and then 2 rounds at Harvey Penick. And Saturday is a cut. So more of the old guard of disc golfers are going to really like this tournament. Like the Barsby, Yuli, Nico, because Sprinkle Valley is very reminiscent of more of an OG disc golf course. So don't be surprised if you see some of your older favorite players up near the top for this event. But overall, I think 2 solid courses. There's not really a hole that I necessarily dislike at Sprinkle Valley. There's Eagle's metric of saying a course is good or not. I think the lines are fair. There's not a whole lot of twizzlers in the fairways. They're pretty well defined, which is something that I appreciate. So I'm excited to get out there and play. And we have the Pro-Am that we're playing today, the MVP Pro-Am. It's Simon, myself, Madison Walker, and Germ playing with some amateur disc golfers. So that'll be a good experience for us and them. And it'll actually be Simon's first round at Sprinkle Valley, so Simon doesn't even really know what to expect. Or maybe
my one and only practice round I get this week is going to be at an event. So I don't know what to think of it yet.
And it's only 9 holes, this Pro-Am.
Oh, are you sure?
It is?
Yeah.
I thought we got to play a whole round.
But you keep talking. Let me confirm
Joey,
that.
Your job is to find out which 9 holes so I can practice the other 9 holes before. We might go back and have lunch there. They have nice food trucks there. I'm really happy with
here we go.
That place's existence.
A pro-am with a shotgun start on holes 1 through 9 will take place starting at 3 p.m. on Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
So we play a hole 18, but it's a shotgun start. So we'll have groups on 1 through 9.
Okay.
Because Jeff Spring said it's basically a practice round for us.
All right, well, I'll figure it out regardless. I'm not too worried about it. I have momentum. And if it's a short, fun wooded track, you know, I like it.
I think you'll like this course. If you like disc golf, you're going to like Sprinkle Valley.
Good. Yeah, I'm a fan. My practice yesterday was questionable at best. I played 18 holes of golf on Monday, and I think if I have to play a disc golf tournament on a Thursday, I will never do that again because I am sore and I'm tired. So, yeah, mental note. Golf is for other days.
Golf is for other days.
Well, to end this podcast, I am going to do one very quick segment of unsolicited advice.
Ooh.
It's literally one podcast episode I listen to when I'm traveling. It's a new podcast I've been listening to called Diary of a CEO. Stephen Bartlett. And I think he's really good at taking people who are really smart about certain things and forcing them to explain the things they're really good at in layman's terms, which for those who don't know what that means, it's just dumbing it down so the people who aren't experts in that field can understand what's going on. And I listened to an episode on my way down to Florida that had a very significant impact on me, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. And so it's from this January, and I'll just read out the title of it. It's The Dopamine Expert: Doing This Once a Day Fixes Your Dopamine. And it's on the Diary of a CEO podcast, and it's about an hour and a half long, and it is one of the most profound explanations of why we as human beings get addicted to something. And this neuroscientist essentially makes the claim that humans are, because of dopamine, humans are wired to be addicted to something. So it's no wonder why most people in the world are addicted to something. And it might not be what we think as addiction. It can be anything that you do on a repetitive basis. But it really, really opened my eyes and my mind to the relationship that our brains have with dopamine, and essentially the fact that our society has outpaced our chemical evolution. And we used to live in a world where dopamine was essentially a reward after a long strenuous effort of some sort. And now we live in a world where dopamine is readily available everywhere. And this woman does a really, really fantastic job of explaining sort of how you can manage it and why it's changed. And she really like kind of provided some insights that I
our hopes
really
right
about.
Now is that you're releasing dopamine when listening to this podcast.
That's right. All right, what's our episode name? Is it Scorpion Palace, or what was the other one you said?
Which one did
Sabotage.
I liked I'm a Defy Guy, but...
I'm a Defy Guy. That's fine.
Isopod Palace.
Isopod Palace.
Insect Palace. Scorpion Palace. When are you going to have the option to call a podcast Scorpion Palace?
I like it. It rolls off the tongue.
All right, Scorpion Palace it is.
Well, Peppies.
Scoville units.
Oh, yeah.
Our little scoves.
A little scoves. I will give you the slightest sneak peek that we are in the beginning phases of some merch design. So I can't give any timelines, but it's being thought about. And my goal for before the next episode is to create an email that we can get fans to write into, so that I'll talk about that, or at least say the name of the email address on the next episode, so that we have a place that people can write in that's all specifically sorted. And
that'll make for some good segments.
Oh, I agree. 100%. Yeah. So thanks everyone for listening. Next week will be remote recording. We'll all be back home. Well,
I'll be in Alabama.
Oh, you're going to Huntsville?
Roll Tide.
You're going to Huntsville?
Roll Tide.
Roll Tide, baby. But
I'll be in Minnesota.
Oh my gosh. That's something.
Oh, we can't say why yet though. So let's see. Well, we won't say why.
You'll be in Minnesota.
I'll be in Minnesota.
You guys can try to guess why. We'll see you next week. You little units.
Units. Thank you for listening, everybody. See you later.
Crush Pepper XL.